So just briefly, most of you have been in the class, and so this is just the quickest kind of recollection because it's been 2 weeks since we've been together. I just want to remind you of the main bullets. We have Cyrus the Great, best known, most famously known for what? What do we remember him for? And the deafening roar of the response from the audience just knocks over the teacher. He's the one who liberated the Jewish people. Remember that? All right. This is why we like him. He comes, 539, defeats the Babylonians, Belshazzar, handwriting on the wall, and then within a year or two authorizes God's people to return to Jerusalem and begin rebuilding the temple there. And Josephus tells us the reason he did that was because he saw his own name there in the record, the prophecy written by Isaiah. So we have Cyrus the Great first of all. He's followed by Cambyses, his not-so-impressive son, who spends most of his time in Egypt, doesn't like the Jewish people so much, and in fact impedes further progress on the work on the temple. And so it more or less stalls out for a while and remains a half-built temple there in Jerusalem, kind of an eyesore. That continues to be the case under my favorite name, Pseudo-Smertus. Pseudo-Smertus, who's also known as Gaumata, who was a Median, is trying to recover the Medo-Persian Empire to Median control, and more importantly, reinstate the Median religion, which is known as Magiism. But as it turns out, he's not successful because within a few months of his career beginning as the ruler of the Medes and the Persians, he's assassinated by our hero, Darius the Great, who along with six co-conspirators get into the palace. It's a wonderful story. Herodotus tells it in all of its made-for-movies details, so if you're reading Herodotus, you'll come to that at a certain point and you'll probably enjoy the story. But that takes place in 522. Darius reinstates the policies of Cyrus and commits himself to the completion of the building of the temple in Jerusalem. And in fact, we have both Persian records and also biblical records to support that. So the job is finished. As you know, the temple is completed in 516, exactly 70 years after it was destroyed by the Babylonians in 586. And so we looked at the career of Darius last time. And that brings us now to the character that's before us. All these guys are great. You notice that? I try to sell that to my students at school. You know, Gore the Great. They're not buying it. I don't know. But Xerxes does qualify as great. Gore the Great, not so much. Xerxes the Great, yes indeed. So from 486 to 464, he is our center of interest here. There's two things about him in particular that we want to remember. One is that he does appear to be the character who is the husband of Esther in the biblical account. And as I say, the name Ahasuerus, which you read in Esther, is essentially the Hebrew version of the Greek word Xerxes. We call him Xerxes because that is the name that's most commonly used, because a lot of what we know about him comes from Herodotus, who's a Greek historian. And we, you know, his Persian name is a little harder to say, and so basically Xerxes is the name that we commonly will use to apply to this guy. The other thing that is of interest is that he fought and lost what's called the Second Persian War. So I want to look at both of those this morning, the Second Persian War and also this account of what took place in connection with Esther. The final years of his reign are somewhat obscure. We don't have a lot of Persian records to give us information about it, nor does Herodotus tell us a whole lot, except that he sort of implies that the latter years of this guy are not all that impressive, and a certain amount of dissolute living, if you know, it would be something like that. Now that may again be Herodotus. He doesn't like Xerxes, and so he may be spinning this just a little bit more in favor of Greek perspectives, but we'll leave that at that. So Xerxes the Great, he inherits from his predecessor Darius this huge empire. So if you can see the map, you'll notice off to the right on the map, the Persian holdings go clear up and really are contiguous with India. Way off to the right, to the left rather, we have the Persians controlling Egypt. Cambyses had actually successfully taken control of Egypt, and Egypt remains under Persian control until Alexander the Great, who is going to still be a couple of hundred years in the future. Up to the north and the west, we have the Persian controlling all of Anatolia, Turkey, and actually having a pretty good-sized toehold in Europe. And so all of that gray area there represents the region that Xerxes is controlling. Jerusalem has finished the temple as of 516. It continues in operation all through this period. In fact, the second temple, as it's called, continues uninterrupted, the daily sacrifices, all the way down to the end of that second temple, which is when it's destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD, with one exception. There's about a three-year break, which takes place in connection with what's called the Maccabean Revolt. And so the Jerusalem operation is more or less shut down for a time under the Syrian intrusion there. And we're going to look at the Maccabean Revolt and that entire era in this spring. We'll be looking at it probably in about a month from now. So otherwise, the Jerusalem temple continues all through this time. Xerxes, when he first took the throne, has to put down some revolts. This is not uncommon. We know that a regime change always seemed to be an opportunity for those who were under the thumb of this imperial control to try to seize this opportunity to get out from under that authority. And so both we find in Babylon and also in Egypt, there's an attempt to do so. It is unsuccessful. But it does take the better part of a year or two for Xerxes to deal with those rebellions. And so that brings us then to 483, when things have quieted down. Herodotus doesn't give us any of this account, but the biblical account would say that it's at this time now that Xerxes begins to celebrate the holdings that he now has full control of, and this would take place in his third year. The book of Esther tells us that he held a great feast in his third year. Now, his third year is 483. We reckon his first year is 485, because 486 belongs to his predecessor. So that's the way the chronology is generally reckoned. So if 485 was his first full year, then 483 would be in his third year, and that would be indeed when he would be having such a celebration. And in fact, we have some indication that he did have this celebration. What we don't hear of from Herodotus, but we do hear of from Esther, is that it's at that time, for some reason, he wants Vashti to come and sort of display her beauty. I don't know exactly what that meant, and some people put a rather, you know, kind of negative view of what all of that entailed. I don't know, but anyway, that's the way the story reads there in Esther chapter 1. As a result of that, Vashti is deposed, and that's the end of the account from Esther for the time being. The next big event that takes place in the career of Xerxes is the First Persian War. What takes place is in 481, after mustering a huge army, he marches across Turkey and arrives in Sardis. Now, Herodotus tells us this is a 1 million-man army. Probably not. Most historians who look at that say that would be not only unprecedented in history, but almost unimaginable. The logistics of keeping a 1 million-man army going in this long march and actually carrying them over into the Greek peninsula seems outrageous. And so most historians who believe this does happen, I mean, obviously the Second Persian War took place, but put the size of the army probably more in the range of 200,000 or 300,000, maybe 400,000 at the most. And so that's what we'll assume. Herodotus is spinning this story a little bit because he's a Greek. And this is the classic David and Goliath situation that he wants to portray for us. Here's little Greece facing this gargantuan attack by the Persians, but what happens? The Greeks win. And Herodotus is very proud of the Greeks, and so he tells the story, and clearly you see that Greek bias coming through, but nevertheless, most of what he gives us is regarded as pretty accurate. So here comes a huge army. They arrive in Sardis, the Persian capital, really, in Asia Minor there, in 481. From that point, they send emissaries out through the Greek peninsula seeking for the standard symbols of submission. And what would happen is they would request earth and water. Earth and water stood for the fundamental resources of a particular region, and by sending samples of each back, it was a symbol of saying, we submit to you and we're submitting our resources to you. So these guys go all through the Greek peninsula. Most of the cities they come to freely surrender earth and water. They're not going to pick a fight with the Persians until these guys get to Athens. In Athens, these emissaries are summarily executed and thrown down a well. So the Athenians don't submit quite so readily. And of course, that is picking a fight big time then with the Persians. As a result of that, the Greeks know they have a problem. They have bowed their back. They're not the least bit willing to surrender, but at the same time, they know that they have a major fight on their hands because they know there's this huge army over there in Sardis and that the following year, undoubtedly, they're going to be facing them. They have a big debate among themselves as to whether they should meet the Persians primarily at sea or on land. The Athenians are arguing more for sea. The Spartans are arguing more for a land defense. They have a big debate, and as it turns out, they decide they'll do both. The Athenian naval admiral Themistocles is assigned the responsibility to handle the naval forces, and the Spartan king Leonidas is assigned the task of handling the land forces. Of course, both forces are much, much smaller than this imposing Greek presence, but nevertheless, they're going to do their best. So these are names I know you're familiar with, Themistocles, Leonidas. These two are the great champions of the Second Persian War. 480, the army crosses over from Asia into Europe. It's a great kind of bridge that's created, quite an engineering feat, and the army marches over. The fleet of the Persians hugs the Greek coast. So they're coming down more or less together to attack Athens and to attack the cities of the Peloponnese. And that's, of course, what launches then the Second Persian War. Well, as this force comes along, Thrace, the first region, immediately submits. Thessaly immediately submits. Macedon is not mentioned directly, but presumably they didn't put up a fight. And so the Persians march through more or less unopposed. What the Greeks decide to do is to post themselves at two strategic locations. One of them is called Thermopylae, literally means hot gates or gates of fire, and the other is Artemisium, which is a little peninsula out on the sea, and so they're going to post their forces respectively at the land pass, known as Thermopylae, and the sea access there at Artemisium. So what happens, you kind of see how they're forming a defensive barricade at that point. And what happens is the Persians come down and they encounter the Greeks then at those two locations. The most famous battle of the Second Persian War is the battle at Thermopylae. And there was a movie that was made a few years ago, you may recall, called 300. Anybody see that? 300. It was great special effects. Not too far off the actual historical event. They do portray Xerxes a little bigger than life, and Leonidas, who knows, but it's a wonderful movie and lots of fun if you don't mind a lot of bloodshed and kind of spraying guts all over the place. But otherwise, it's a great entertaining experience. What really happened was the Persians are coming down the Greek peninsula and they're being funneled into this rather narrow pass. Now, the Spartans were by far the most powerful, efficient warriors of the ancient world. Everybody knew that. And kind of a fair, game would be, one Spartan for every 10 Persians. That was essentially what was expected. One Spartan per 10. That's a fair fight. You know, that's how good these guys were. But it was, one Spartan versus 100 is a little over the top. Well, the Thermopylae Pass was a good way to sort of reduce the overall numbers of the Persians into a fairly narrow kind of ravine there, in a sense, so that the Persians would be faced with, in other words, the Persians could only send a certain rather finite number of people through this pass, and that was how the Greeks thought that they could hold them off. They were hoping they could hold them off indefinitely so that the Persians would eventually turn around and go home. Well, they did hold them off for a while. It was about 10,000 Greeks fighting here versus the forces of Persia, which were many, many times larger than that. But then somebody betrayed the Greeks with a kind of back door around the pass of Thermopylae, so the Persians were able to come around and attack them both from the front and the rear. And that made an impossible situation. When Leonidas realized what had happened, he dismissed most of the Greeks to go and fight another day, saving there just the 300. And so that's this famous occasion where the 300 Spartans face the huge, huge forces of the Persians. And even at that, they're able to hold them off for about a week. And that gives the Greeks a chance to run down to the Bay of Salamis, where the major battle of this conflict would take place. So the Battle of the 300 Spartans takes place there. This is what Thermopylae looks like today. You'll notice that it's actually a pass that's right on the edge of the sea. So you've got mountains on the one hand, on the left of the image. You don't see the sea on the right, but the sea level was higher in the ancient world, and so it created this sort of narrow pass where you could only have a few hundred Persians coming through at any given moment. If you drive through this region today, you'll find this great monument that's there, Leonidas and his famous 300 fighting off the Persians. So that's what it looks like. The major battle that takes place in the Second Persian War is at the Bay of Salamis, which looks like this. If you can see there, that little area, the area that's right between the Greek mainland and the Peloponnese, is called the Bay of Salamis. And what happened was the Greeks were able to induce the Persians' larger ships into that bay, the more light Greek triremes, then just batter away at them. It's kind of a rout in which the heavy Persian ships are not able to maneuver effectively, and so that's the end of the story. Herodotus tells us a funny little anecdote about Xerxes, that he was sitting up in the grandstands. You know, he'd set up this nice little bleacher where he could eat popcorn and, you know, hot dogs and watch what he thought was going to be destruction of the Greeks. And he gradually becomes more and more alarmed as he sees that the Persians are losing, and he knows that if they really do lose the way it looks like they are, he himself might be at risk. So finally he decides, enough of this, and he quickly packs up and heads for home and leaves his forces there to do the best they can. But they do indeed lose this battle, and so it's a big embarrassing black eye for the Persians and a wonderful moment of glory for the Greeks in Second Persian War. The mop-up operations took place the following year in Plataea on the Greek peninsula and Mycale over in Asia Minor. And that's basically it. That's the story of the Second Persian War. I may have taken more time on it than I should have, but hey, we love ancient history, don't we? Isn't it fun? It's good stuff. Has really nothing to do with biblical history, but, you know, there it is, and so we'll just include it in our little narrative. The Second Persian War takes place from 481 to 479. As we say, Xerxes returns home, and according to the book of Esther, the events recorded in Esther take place in his seventh year, which would be precisely the year that he would be back in town after the Second Persian War. So again, no distinct records of this from Persian sources, but it very much is compatible with the chronology that we otherwise understood took place. So, in Esther chapter 2, we have a record then of the replacement of Vashti taking place there. And of course, in that process, Esther is chosen in this wonderful story that unfolds at that point. That's all in 478. Then in 472, we hear about this plot by a sinister character in the Persian court named Haman, H-A-M-A-N. Haman is said to be an Agagite. Anybody recall who Agag was? Who was Agag? Does that name ring a bell? Agag? Anybody recall what he was? Where does he pop up? Do you remember? Who is he? Yeah, go ahead. Okay, this is Agag is an Amalekite, and he's mentioned in the story of Saul, which is many years earlier. And you may recall Samuel had told Saul to go and get rid of the Amalekites. They were the perennial enemies of God's people. They had been hostile to them all along, and it was kind of like a holy war situation. Go eliminate these people. Get rid of them. Saul goes off obediently and makes war against the Amalekites, but in the process says, you know, these are fairly nice people. And they have a lot of nice livestock. And so Saul kind of compromises the command that had been given to him by God through Samuel and saves the best, spoils of war. And of course, it's a great incident, you recall it, when Samuel comes and is finding out how the war has gone, and he says, "What's the bleating of sheep that I hear in the background? And what is this, you know, kind of deal?" And Saul is making all sorts of excuses. But that begins to be the time when Saul's fortunes begin to change. Agag was the king of the Amalekites who was spared by Saul at that point. And Haman then, many, many years later, is said to be an Agagite. He's a descendant of these who Saul spared. And of course, the lesson that we might learn from that is, you know, if Jesus says there's something in your life you need to get rid of, then get rid of it. You know, don't just compromise with it and make a deal with it, get rid of it. And so anyway, here they are, the Amalekites coming back once again, more ferocious than ever, and mounting this huge attack, really, and a threat to the Jewish people. So Haman is the one who is able, by a kind of trickery, to get the king to sign off on this order, essentially, that would be genocide against the Jewish people. That is said to take place in the 12th year of the reign of Xerxes. And so that is the moment when then we have this story that we just read of here in the book of Esther, in which, of course, Mordecai directs his niece, now queen, in. She, at the risk of life and limb, is prepared to go in and confront Xerxes. And if you know the story of Esther, you know that she invites him over, and Haman is exposed and eventually hanged, and the Jewish people are liberated through all of that, and we have the Feast of Purim, as it's called in Jewish festivals, to commemorate that moment. The shrine to Esther and Mordecai is found in Iran. It looks like this, and inside you'll find these two kind of coffin sort of affairs that are presumably the remains of Mordecai and Esther. So it's interesting, there's some indication. The rest of the reign of Xerxes, as I say, is fairly obscure. And what I'd like to do then in the time that we have is just return to the thoughts about Esther here. And this is my Sunday school lesson for the morning. So I'd like to have you think about this moment when Mordecai says to Esther that she needs to go in and confront Xerxes. Not confront him, really, but at least come in and represent, intercede for the Jewish people. And notice, first of all, in verse 14, Mordecai says to Esther, "If you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter, but you and your father's family will perish." And then he says, "Who knows? Perhaps you have come to the kingdom," is the word there, "for just such a time as this." One of the more famous remarks, and you've of course heard it colloquially, maybe you've come to the kingdom for just such a time as this. There was nobody in the world who was in the same position as Esther. She had, by the providential care of God, been brought to a position where she could do something nobody else could do. It's very interesting, the book of Esther never mentions God once. He's never mentioned. There's no mention to some sort of supernatural, providential care. And yet providence is breathing throughout the book. All of the timing, all of the close calls, all of the little details show that while God is never mentioned, he's in the machinery all the way through. And I think that's part of the reason it's said just that way. And Mordecai says to Esther, "Who knows? Maybe you've been brought to the kingdom for such a time as this." There was nobody like Esther. So my first point in my Sunday school lesson is that there's nobody like you. There's nobody else who is you. And there's nobody who's had the experiences, the moments of education, the training, the wisdom, all of the things that have been accumulating to make you the person you uniquely are is shared by nobody else. And there's nobody else in precisely your life circumstance. And I just want to say to you, who knows? Maybe you have been brought to the kingdom for just this moment. You see, where has God put you? What conversation can you have that nobody else could have? What possibilities are in your life right now that nobody else has access to? What is it that's uniquely part of your situation right now that makes you like Esther, a person who's come to the kingdom for just such a time as this? Because we are in God's kingdom, you know. God is building his kingdom, he's building his temple, and we are all living stones within it. And there's no stone that can play the role that you can play. You are unique in that great edifice. So that's point number one. Ask yourself, has God called you right now to the kingdom for just such a time as this? Number two, again from the same text, verse 15. Then Esther said in reply to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa, hold a fast on my behalf, and neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will also fast as you do. After that, I will go to the king." Notice what Esther doesn't say. "Hey, Mordecai, I got you. I'm with you. Okay, I mean, the king likes me. No problemo. I'm going to run right in there and we'll have a little chat." Esther has a respectable amount of fear and hesitation. And she understands what God had said to Zerubbabel through Zechariah the last time we were together. "Not by might nor by power, but by my spirit." So the balancing lesson here is there's nobody like you. You are unique, but don't think you can go it alone. I don't care how many letters you've got after your name, how many credentials, how much experience, how much wisdom, how much anything. Jesus says, without me, you can do nothing. And even Queen Esther, as privileged and honored as she had been, was not going to presumptively invade into this program without being reinforced by prayer and fasting. And so whatever it is that you feel God may be calling you to do, don't think you can do it without that strength that only comes by his grace. Pray, fast, whatever it takes, you know, make sure that as you are pursuing this course, you are doing it with God's sanction and God's power. And then our third little lesson that comes in this very famous comment right at the end. "After that, I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." It sounds a bit like resignation, but it isn't exactly that, is it? It is the comment a person will embrace that will make them the most courageous. "If I perish, I perish." Once you've reached that state of mind, what is there to fear? Now, if you're still hanging on, hedging your bets, worrying about outcomes, you got some things to worry about. But if you say, "If I perish, I perish," well, then the pressure's off. Jesus says, "Do you want to be my disciple? Take up your cross." Not take up your bazooka. Take up your hand grenade. Take up your martial arts. Take up your this or that. Take up your cross. And of course, the disciples who heard that in the first century heard it somewhat differently than we do. We've had 2,000 years to sort of sentimentalize that statement. But they thought about the typical Roman practice of forcing people condemned to death to take up their cross and drag it out to the place of execution, just as Jesus himself was required so to do. "You want to be my disciple? Grab your cross and follow me to what you must assume is the place of your own execution. And if you perish, you perish." But the fact is, if a man is going to hang on to his life, he will lose it. But the person who's prepared to surrender his life will gain it, and so much more besides. There is in the life of Christian faith and understanding a kind of self-surrender. Paul says in Romans chapter 12, "Present your bodies a living sacrifice." Sacrifices usually die. You ever notice that? sacrifices don't ordinarily survive. And yet Paul uses an oxymoronic statement there, a living sacrifice. If you perish, you perish. It's not so bad. But every day, there's an opportunity to once again take up that cross, to once again go in before the King, to once again know you're putting everything at risk, but to once again know that God in His providence may have brought you to the kingdom just such a time as this. So that we with Esther can be that person God uses to accomplish His purpose.